A Simcar 7. The transportationist David Levinson joins us to discuss the technical, human, environmental, and economic factors driving change in the auto system ecosystem. David helps us survey the landscape via human behaviors, technology life cycles, urban transportation evolution, networks, and congestion. Welcome to A Simcar, David. Maybe you can give us a little background on your work, and we'll go from there.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I've been doing a lot of work in travel behavior and how land use and transportation interact, and recently I've taken some interest in this phenomenon of peak traffic, peak travel demands that we've seen. So in the United States and in other developed countries, we've seen a decline in the amount of travel per person and a decline in overall travel in the last decade. And the questions arise, why does this happen? What's going on in our society that's changing? Because if you look at the trends from the 1920s through the 1990s, it was a straight line increase in the amount of travel that people were making, and It's leveled off.
So just quick, why don't you let us know more about yourself first, because sort of what's your background, just because I'm curious, I'm sure people are curious where you're coming from.
Sure. I'm a civil engineer. I did my bachelor's degree at Georgia Tech and my PhD at the University of California at Berkeley. And I did work in transportation economics, and my dissertation was on whether states choose to implement toll roads or gas tax for financing roads. And I came to the University of Minnesota in 1999, and I've been teaching at the Department of Civil Engineering here since then.
Wow, okay, so quite a long time at the in that university then, I guess, 14 years or so. So, the reason we wanted to reach out to you is that one of the patterns we've observed, and this was actually mostly Jim's observation, is that we're sort of reaching, especially in the United States, what some people call peak car or peak travel by road, and it's an interesting phenomenon. We're not quite sure whether it's driven by demographic change, whether it's driven by costs, whether people are simply living differently than they used to, and, you know, telecommuting, for example, as a lifestyle. And what's your take? What are the contributing factors? Is it one big thing, or is it a lot of little things?
I think it's a number of things. So if you start with the day, 24 hours on the clock, and how much of that are you willing to spend traveling? And you want to sleep for, let's say, 8 hours, and you want to work for, let's say, 8 hours if you're a worker, you've got a maximum of 4 hours of discretionary time. Now, sort of at the upper limit, you could spend 4 hours going to your job and 4 hours coming back, but that would leave you no time to do anything else. And so what's the point? People have settled into what's been referred to as a travel time budget. I think the word budget's probably a little bit strong, but a budget of about 60 to 90 minutes per day of traveling. Now, if speeds continue to rise, then you can travel longer and longer distances in the same amount of time. But if speeds aren't rising, you're going to be traveling roughly the same amount of distance if you're fixed the amount of time that you're willing to spend travel. So I think we've reached saturation in that, given the current state of technology in the United States, almost everyone who can have a car has a car, and there's a limit to how fast we can go, given the technology of roads that we have deployed. We've built out the interstate highway system that finished, it was being built from 1956, finished in 1992 or so. And since then, we haven't added a lot of new major roads, and so speeds have not increased much, and with rising populations in places, they've decreased because of congestion. So if we're only going to drive for 60 to 90 minutes a day, or travel for 60 to 90 minutes a day, there's only so much travel that we can do. And I think that's sort of the structure under which we're operating. Now, then there's a question of, well, if you're not a worker, you could travel more, but if you're not a worker, you don't have to go to work every day. So it turns out non-workers travel less than workers do typically. And from a traffic perspective, more importantly, they tend to travel less in the peak and more in the off peak. And so that's something that's going on. In the 2000s, gas prices increased, particularly in the middle part of the decade up through 2008, 2009. That must have had an effect. How much of an effect is hard to say because there's lots of other things going on. We entered the recession. That certainly had an effect. But that's, you know, if fewer people are going to work, then fewer people are making work trips. And if fewer people have jobs or people are afraid about their jobs, they shop less. So that's going on. We have the internet rising, allowing people to do telework, but I think sort of under-recognized is the amount of online shopping that's going on, which if I can buy something on Amazon rather than trudging out to the local shopping mall or big box store, maybe I'll do that. And that saves a trip or two. And so that has an effect. And then we've had some policy changes. So we've made it harder for young people to get driver's licenses, and we've made it less valuable for them to get driver's licenses. So when I was 16, I got my driver's license on my 16th birthday.
Exactly.
And I was very pleased to pass because I didn't want to remember my 16th birthday. It's not passing my driver's license exam. Mm-hmm. But and I didn't have my own car. I used my mom's car when I was making trips, but I was allowed to, you know, after a couple of weeks, I was allowed to drive without any adult supervision. Now you can't drive at night without adult supervision. You can't drive with any other kids in the car without adult supervision. And all of these are good things and enhance safety, but it makes it less useful to actually have a driver's license when you're 16 years old. And if you don't get it when you're 16 or 17, then you go to college, maybe you decide you don't really need it. And so people have been putting off the age at which they get their driver's license and buy their car. And then the economy hasn't helped that much. And the internet and social networking and other things have provided valuable substitutes for some amount of travel. I mean, certainly not a perfect substitute, and it doesn't eliminate all travel, but if it shaves a little bit off the edges here and there, we get to a place where travel per person is declining.
Mm. I'm struck by this sort of immutable law of time spent traveling. I actually saw data. I'm going to try to link to it in the blog post that actually historically, even I'm looking at it right now, some data coming from all the way from 1900 about how many hours per week people spend traveling or commuting, to be more precise. And it's actually been fairly constant. Pretty much they didn't go far because they didn't have rapid transit, but they were spending the same amount of time. So sort of in terms of, like you said, the 24-hour day, the budget allocated to travel has been constant, at least for centuries. And how much people spend on sleep, leisure, work, and household are also fairly constant. This is, by the way, across many, many countries. It's studied across the world, not just the U.S. So there is something to that. And I think you're right about a lot of the demographic changes, a lot of the economic changes, and a lot of the technological changes that are affecting our behavior. Certainly, maybe we may travel an equal amount, but we may spend some of that travel budget on leisure travel rather than work travel. The type of leisure may change as we rely less on, let's say, traveling to a mall when we have Amazon. So we don't want to socialize necessarily the same way. And certainly a travel for the sake of children may change as well, as we may, you know, do more, less of one type of entertainment and another. So that's certainly interesting. And I think if I had more time available, I might probably spend it. If I didn't have to go to work travel, I may actually drive somewhere just for the hell of it, just for fun. So that's an interesting observation. Where I live, public transport is so good that driving is less a necessity and more something you might do for leisure. And you might but it is so expensive that very few people do that. And I think the same phenomenon you're observing in the U.S. with decreased excitement around getting your license that's even worse here because costs are extremely high to get a license. Costs thousands of euros to get the schooling needed, and exams and everything else, plus cars, and cars are taxed exorbitantly. They're nearly 200% the cost in the U.S. And then of course you have gas. But so okay, having gone through that, I think what we want to understand is what's this going to have as an effect on how vehicles and how transportation systems will change as we go forward in terms of, do you see, you know, we see a lot of excitement around not just powertrains like electric, but we also see excitement around more intelligent vehicles. Vehicles that are not necessarily owned by individuals, but rather shared or leased, that are kind of city car type concepts. Would you see, when you look at this list of evolution of transportation, what excites you most? Is it the driverless car? Should we get excited about that? Should we get excited about these mass transit solutions out there that people are dreaming up, or electric in general? What's your take on this?
Well, I mean, I think it depends on where you are. So you can sort of divide the world into two types of places: places that were built before the automobile and places that were built after the automobile. And places that were built before the automobile, many older European cities, the cores of many American cities, were built around walking and streetcars, and have typically high enough land densities and population densities that they can effectively support transit, and biking is a reasonable option, and not owning a car is a plausible choice. And then there's places in the U.S. and suburban areas in Europe and developing world and other places that were built post-automobile. And the land form there assumes that people who live there have cars, and it's very hard to retrofit that in a way that makes it suitable for a non-automobile lifestyle. So within the car-oriented places, driverless cars are going to be very, very important, I think, because not only, you know, if you're willing to drive an hour a day, you still have to focus, we hope, on the driving task. And if you're not driving, if you're in a driverless car an hour a day, you can do something else with that time. So that frees up a waking hour a day for somebody to do something else. And that's a huge amount of time gain, assuming they're still willing to travel for an hour. But if they're not doing something else, they might be willing to travel for longer. So the trends that we've seen in peak travel might change again if we have a technological shift which changes the nature of travel, so that it's not something that you're focused on. It's something that's happening while you're doing something else. I don't know why people would travel 4 hours a day, but if you look at how people behave, if they're going to be taking a commuter train, those trips are typically significantly longer than trips by driving, because people on commuter trains can do something else. And so if a driverless car makes the world more like commuter trains and less like automobiles as we imagine them today, I'd expect that the people who are using those vehicles would use them for longer. Now, within cities, we could go in a different direction. We don't have to. I mean, cars are less useful in cities than they are in suburbs. Technology might create other options. So we could think about, you know, if you have a very high density area, having driverless vehicles doesn't mean driverless cars. It can mean driverless buses. And if one of the major costs of bus transportation is labor, if you could somehow reduce that. And I realize there's a lot of labor union issues that will have to be fought out in lots of different places in order for that to happen. But if you could move towards more driverless mass transportation, you can make mass transportation a much more feasible option. We have in some U.S. cities, and certainly not universally, you know, some increase in core cities that we haven't seen for a long time. So most U.S. cities peaked in their population around 1950. And metropolitan areas are still growing, but the central cities themselves have been mostly declining from 1950 through 1990, maybe a little bit of a pickup in 2000, and maybe a little bit of pickup between 2000 and 2010. But as society changes, as there's more young unmarried people, as there's more retired people who are willing to live in cities because they don't have children, you could see the population of cities increase noticeably. And that's sort of a positive feedback system where you have the land density, you have the population that creates a set of services, enables a set of services like mass transit that makes it more valuable to live in cities. So within cities, substitutes for the car, like car owning a car, like car sharing, city car type of ideas, are starting to gain some traction. Now, it's still right now in the U.S. too small to measure from the aggregate statistics. We don't see these things showing up. But in the last year alone in Minneapolis, Car2Go, which I think is a Daimler-Benz unit, has deposited 250 cars in the city of Minneapolis, and you see them around all the time now. And car sharing is beginning to become a popular substitute for people who don't have a car or have a household where they have one less car than they might otherwise have. You know, they have two licensed drivers, but they only have one family car. And as a complement to a transit system, or a complement to a system that where people will bike for their short distance trips, but they still need to go shopping and they might need to buy things that are just too heavy to carry on bicycles. You can start to see that as important within central cities. Now, I think it's going to be less likely to be important in the suburban areas. And after 100 years of suburbanization, the United States is much more suburban than it is urban. But that becomes an important aspect in the core cities. And in the developing world, which is much more urban rather than suburban, I think that these transit options will become even more significant.
So, David, one of the things you mentioned in a recent blog post was you're sort of looking back from 2030 saying, you know, where did the traffic go? And you cited a couple factors. One of them was the changing work week. So, obviously, many times we see technology change, but then behavior change often takes quite a bit longer. So how do you see those two playing? You know, Horace asked you about the technical change and the services change, but do you see the behavior change happening faster, or is this something that will take, as Steve Jobs said many years ago, the mortality rate to solve some of these things?
Yeah. The changing working patterns, and it's a bit speculative, of course. You're looking at the future, and we don't have very strong trends on this. We have, telecommuting has significantly increased over the last 20, 30 years, but most people are not telecommuting most of the time yet.
Right.
But we're starting to see that the technology is in place that it's feasible to do for a lot of tasks at work. Now, that doesn't mean that all tasks at your job can be done this way. You know, I still have to go to my class and meet my class in person. I mean, we can imagine, for instance, massive open online courses that I would record my video lectures and people would take it all online, but there's still something to be gained from in-person interaction. Other work types of interactions are important that way. So if you have an office job, you still have meetings, but a lot of it can now be done remotely. And so the question is, if you can organize the workday in a way that you go into work for the meetings that have to be at the workplace and you stay home for the things that don't have to be at the workplace, or you go to a cafe or you go anywhere else, corporations might have some incentive to do this because this will save them money on rent for office buildings. They might have happier employees if they don't have to come to work 5 days a week, but instead only come in 2 or 3 days a week. So we can see that there might be some incentives to move in this direction. And a lot of there's copying behavior. A lot of companies don't want to be the first ones to do this, especially companies that interact a lot with other companies. So if you have suppliers and customers who expect you to be there 5 days a week, you're going to expect your employees to be there 5 days a week. But if you're a company that whose customers and vendors are also on a 4 day a week schedule, maybe you can cut back to a 4 day a week schedule. And so, I mean, there's been a long over a long period of time, we have reduced the number of hours that we've worked in the United States. We still have the 40-hour week as the nominal standard. If you look at European countries, and they're fewer hours per week and certainly fewer weeks per year. So it's possible to be as productive with fewer hours at the office or fewer hours being paid for. And that doesn't mean that every job can be that way. I don't imagine police officers will be telecommuting that much. I don't imagine, you know, that there's other types of jobs, nurses and things, that you have to be in a physical place at a physical time, that that's not going to happen for everybody. But there's a lot of things that it can happen for. And so the question is, why hasn't it? So I mentioned the idea of, you know, flipping the workplace. We're talking about flip the classroom, where instead of a professor standing in front of the classroom giving a lecture, the professor records the lecture, and in the classroom we work out problems. And we're starting to do that more and more. Well, what if we flip the office? So instead of going to the office as a place to do work, we only go to the office as a place to interact, and we do the work somewhere else. And we can still be virtually connected via Skype or any number of other technologies with the people that we work with, but we don't have to physically be present all the time. That kind of model can have important impacts on the workplace, but from a transportation perspective, we think it's great because if people are only going to work 4 days a week instead of five, we've significantly reduced the number of peak hours of travel per week. And if we can stagger those 4 days a week so that they're not all the same, so it's not everybody's working Monday to Thursday instead of Monday to Friday, but instead some people are off on Monday, some people are off on Wednesday, some people are off on Friday, then we would have made significant progress just from that in terms of traffic levels. Now, there's the phenomenon of induced demand that we see a lot. So when we build a new road or we widen a road, we have an expectation that we're going to reduce congestion, but it turns out when we reduce the travel times on roads, people switch from other routes, they switch from other times of day, they make longer trips, they travel where they previously didn't travel, so we don't get all of the congestion benefits that we'd expect. But we still get some of them. And so that's something to think about as a one of the possible trends, you know. And I would expect that if we've made a lot of increases in productivity, that some people will want to take them as fewer days at work rather than just working more hours to get a higher income. We should see somewhat less work travel. And work travel is not the most number of trips are due to work, but it is the most peaked number of trips, and therefore it's the cause of the congestion problems that we have.
I have sort of a alt view of, or alt question of this. I was at a conference in Chicago a couple weeks ago, and there was a delegation from Hamburg there and other urban planners, and they all think that the driverless cars and the increasing appeal of mass transportation, better information on mass transportation via smartphones and all that will add increasing returns to urban environments. So the cities will keep getting bigger. And the thing I wonder about is, you know, if the work style evolves somewhat as you considered, David, would the suburbs be more appealing? You know, if you can use that time to do work in your car or shop or, you know, whatever it is, or interact with your family, would we see something change in that? Would people want to have more space or, you know, live out in a less congested environment? Do you have any views on, because you sort of mentioned this concept of empty office buildings because of these changes, but, you know, do you think that people will then value more flexibility, more open space than living in the cities?
Well, I think different people will value different things. It'll allow a more efficient sorting of getting people closer to their preferences. So people who like cities aren't necessarily people who work in cities. So students like cities. I mean, they're going to school at a university in the city, but you go to a city because there's a lot of things going on. It's a vibrant place. And they, you know, you get a 20-something and you ask them, you know, to move to the suburbs, and many of them just look at you like you're insane, because if they don't have kids, why would they want to be so isolated from other people and their friends? So you could see cities becoming a place that's more efficiently sorted, not necessarily for people who are working there or who have to work there because their job is there, but people who are living there because that's the kind of place they want to live in. And you get enough of them, you get sort of the agglomeration benefits of there are things, entertainment things to do that young singles who are in the meat market want to do. And if there's more demand for cities, given the sort of the total amount of demand available, you know, there's more space available in cities. You expect suburbs to become less expensive. If people can do things while they're traveling, I would expect that, you know, the premiums that we might pay now for suburban areas will diminish because people could live farther out and be just as effective. And so my sense is that the suburbs will start attracting lower income, that you'll see a sorting that's, you know, unusual in the United States, but common in some other countries where the cities are more expensive and the suburbs are where people lower incomes live. But, you know, that doesn't mean that there aren't going to be plenty of people who have a preference for isolation or a preference for greenery or a preference for, you know, certain green aspects of life that are going to want, you know, if they're only going into the city 2 days a week or 1 day a week, that won't live very far away. And instead of commuting a half hour each way 5 days a week, they might commute 5 hours each way 1 day a week or 2 days, you know, 1 day, and then spend overnight in the city and then come back. I mean, there's lots of different kinds of patterns that people could have. And having everybody on sort of this industrial age pattern of everybody goes to work 5 days a week, it's Monday through Friday, except for people in the retail sector and except for people who do shift work, that might fade.
You know, this brings to mind one of the things that I've been thinking about, because of when you think about the global situation, which is quite like you pointed out, it depends, you know, a lot of these questions need to be answered, depending where you are. And what I've noticed is how in Asia now, especially China, there's been obviously a boom in epic proportion, something we haven't seen since the last century in any other part of the world. You know, the famous photograph of the skyline of Shanghai, how the Pudong area was in 1990 nothing but farmland or a couple of small buildings, and now it looks like, well, it's even more impressive than Manhattan. And it grew, within 20 years, that became transformed into an amazing city. But when I go to places like this, and Hong Kong is another, what I'm struck by is how these cities reflect a particular moment in time, actually, because they all were architected and designed and planned and built in a fairly short amount of time. If you go to Tokyo, much of it looks like the 1960s. If you go to Taipei, much of it looks like the 1980s, maybe early 90s. If you go to Hong Kong actually has different parts that have grown up at different times. And then you have these boom towns that clearly reflect that period of maximum growth for that region. So, for example, London is very Victorian for a good reason. It was, you know, mostly what we see was built at the time. New York looks very much 1920s, 30s, maybe up through the 50s. There are, of course, examples of modern architecture, but it's very much all the time. And so, you know, you pointed out how some cities were born pre-automobile and pre-industrial era, even, and so pre-railway. So there's a lot of hub, you know, sort of a centralized model. But what I'm getting at is that a lot of the what we think of modernity today is actually coming out of Asia, and it's being, what is that design philosophy in Taiwan in Shanghai? Because when I saw Shanghai, I said, this is still a city built around the notion of an automobile and maybe mass transit as we know it. They didn't exactly develop the city as if it was for some unforeseen future. It was very much of the moment. This is what 2000s look like to them. You know, that was their vision. So what's going to happen with urban planning as that tends to go in a different cycle than any other technology development or even societal change itself? That it's, how are we going to get stuck with obsolete cities? Are we already stuck with them? What's going to happen to Los Angeles, which is, you know, designed around the freeway.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the conundrums, right? You have cities which are famously, once you lay down the roads, you don't move them. If you look at London after the Great Fire, in 1666, Christopher Wren had a plan for reorganizing the street grid, but it wasn't done, and it wasn't done because the property rights were already established and they wanted to rebuild as quickly as possible, so they rebuilt in place. You know, once the city gets very locked in, and so it's very hard to change. So, you know, eventually you find an obsolete area, for instance, in London, the Docklands, which by the time of container shipping became an obsolete way of handling freight. All the container ships moved out to, I think, Felixstowe, and the Docklands were abandoned, and then they were redeveloped as Canary Wharf, and it became sort of new central business district, skyscraper district for London, and they retrofitted it. And retrofit's hard, and you know that was a massive retrofit in a particular place. But there's lots of other places where we've tried to do retrofit and we've done it badly. So we tried to retrofit in the United States many of our cities for the automobile. So many of the cities that were built before the automobile, we ran freeways through those cities. We tore down lots of buildings to put in parking lots, and we did lots of other things that, from a modern urban, current urban planning perspective, are terrible, but seemed like the right thing to do to 1950s mm-hmm. and 1960s urban planners. So are we doing things today that are mistakes? I think certainly China is making a mistake in given the population densities they have in trying to accommodate the automobile so much. I visited Beijing once in the early 2000s, and that even then you could see that sort of the famous bicycle-oriented city that had bicycles on all of its major roads. Now, the roads were already very wide, but, you know, it had bicycles everywhere. Cars were pushing them to the side, and yeah. It was becoming very hard to operate a bicycle there. And I imagine in the last 10 years, it's become a lot harder. At the time, there were only two subway lines. They've significantly expanded their subway system, their metro system. And I think, you know, that's important. You know, for a city of 15 million people, you'd expect that they would have had a lot more public transport than they did. And the expansion has probably helped move people around, but they're still building as if they expect, if not quite U.S. levels of automobile ownership, perhaps European levels of automobile ownership.
Yeah, and by the time they're done, I think the automobile as we know it will have moved on. I mean, that's what struck me. And then you compare that with, as you mentioned, retrofitting. If you look at Europe, there's a lot of retrofitting of bicycles into urban areas. Certainly, the Netherlands was a pioneer, and during the 70s, they redesigned the entire country, not just the cities. The entire country now is bike friendly, and that's happening also here in the Nordics, and it you know, I think in Germany as well, and it requires quite an extraordinary effort, because you realize how fine-grained the problem is. You can't. It's actually harder, I think, to make a bike-friendly community than it is to make a car-friendly one, because you're dealing with smaller areas of right of way and so on, and it takes almost as much effort to have a crew pave a big road as it is to pave a bike path, given the cost of labor. But anyway, I'm just curious how that's going to play out, because we do see technological change happening quickly, and I think in some automobile sectors. What's your take on electric in general? Is this because of the what people realize fairly quickly? Technology people, as you know, who are sort of leading the way right now, is that it's not so much the vehicle that's the problem; it's the grid that the vehicle rides on. That needs to also be upgraded when you change powertrains. So if you have a new engine, you need to charge new
infrastructure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you need new infrastructure, and certainly Tesla is looking at it that way, as the supercharger network. But is that enough? Do you see private sectors being sufficient, or even not private sector, one company being sufficient sufficiently powerful to drive change in the grid itself?
Yeah, I mean, so electrics are interesting. So we got the Prius in the U.S. in 1999 or 2000, and it started taking off. And I teach a transportation policy planning and deployment course where one of the homework assignments is for the students is to take a technology and project its S-curve trend, its life cycle trend, try to figure out where market saturation is and how quickly it will, you know, reach its inflection point, the 50% market share point. And in 2006, I had a student do this and extrapolating from trends at the time and look saying that if hybrid electric cars were eventually going to be the whole market, they should have reached 50% market share in about 2016. So student did the forecast, very good paper, turned it in, you know, looked at the trends. We've looked at the trends since then, and it sort of peaked in 2009 and then has sort of fallen off. Now, the last couple of years, we've seen a few plug-in electric vehicles hit the market, and they're, you know, again, sort of on this long-term trajectory that, you know, if eventually you would expect that electric will replace gasoline as the energy source of choice. But whether this will sustain beyond the people who are willing to pay a premium for an automobile because it's a signifier of their environmental attitude or because of tax credits, it's not clear that trend will continue on because batteries still have issues that haven't been fully resolved compared to petroleum. So if you look back to 1900, there was a competition between gasoline, electricity, and steam power for automobiles, and the market share of each of them, which was a very small market, of course, was roughly equal, and it wasn't clear at all which one would become dominant. But by 1910, 1915, it was very clear that petroleum would take off and the others would not. And so why is that? Okay, well, there were range problems associated with batteries. And we've had 100 years, and there's still range problems associated with batteries. And we've had 100 years to perfect the automobile based on gasoline, the powertrains that are based on the internal combustion engine. We've spent time working on batteries, and you sort of say, well, surely we will make technological progress here. But it's coming a lot slower than you would think. And so I think we will eventually have electric-powered vehicles, but I'm surprised at how slow the take-up is on that compared to other technological changes. And I think the range issue is a problem, not for city cars, because most people make trips that should be accommodated within the range of existing batteries without much problem. But if you want to make a long-distance trip, you've got to have frequent charging stations, and batteries will sometimes behave funny and discharge faster than are anticipated. And you hear stories about people who run out of battery juice. And, of course, there was a famous story in the New York Times earlier this year about this. And Elon Musk and the New York Times reporter got into a big argument about this. But I've talked to people who are reliable, who have had range issue problems with batteries on long-distance trips. And if it doesn't do long-distance trips, people still have a mindset that their car needs to be reliable enough that they can do that. I think it's going to be a harder sell than some of the optimists are looking for electricity to be the source of energy. Now, then there's the question of, can the grid handle it? And I think the question depends on where you are, depends on how quick the uptake is, right? If you were to do it overnight, clearly the grid couldn't handle it. But if you were to do it over a period of a couple of decades, so a slow electrification of the fleet with use of hybrid electrics more than plug-in electrics as sort of the dominant one at first, I think we'll probably figure out a way to muddle through. I mean, the electricity sector is changing very rapidly as well with all of these new renewable sources coming online. Wind power is especially booming here in the upper Great Plains of the United States. I'd expect that solar is booming similarly in the southwestern states, which get a lot of sunshine. And we'll start to see these new sources coming online, which are more variable, and the grids are going to have to learn to handle this variable input. and they're going to change from, you know, this is going to make it hard for them to be relying on fuels that have large startup costs like nuclear. You don't want to keep turning on and off a nuclear power plant, but maybe makes it more flexible fuels like natural gas would become the fuel of choice for the main power station until renewables become dominant. Mm-hmm. So there's those kinds of changes on the grid. And so, you know, I don't know if you want a new podcast, a Sim Power or something, but there's a lot of changes going on in that sector, which are interesting. Oh,
there indeed is. I actually spent a bit of time looking at smart grid technologies a few years ago, and I was struck by this, by how little the average, well, my own understanding was, but I would imagine it's a sort of a layman's understanding of how the grids work, because the grids are actually, they're not one thing. You know, we take for granted that you plug in and you have power, but in fact, the source of that power has to vary quite a bit during the 24-hour cycle, and there are different types of power used for different jobs to be done in a way. So it's kind of like you have base load, which is usually supplied by coal and nuclear, but then you have peak loads, and peak loads are when people turn on their air conditioners when they get home. So there's that peak and a surge of power needed right around, you know, 6 o'clock in the afternoon, especially, you know, in the southern states. And then you have also, you know, early in the morning when people turn on their coffee machines. And that peak power is actually supplied typically by gas turbines. And these are essentially jet engines that are fed fuel like gas or sometimes other liquid fuels. But basically they can burn quite a range of grade of fuel, but they spin up and then they provide this temporary power. And the thing is, they give it to you in little chunks, so you can turn one turbine or two or three or four, and then that ramps up the power as on a per needed basis. But those are quite expensive, and also the economics of such a turbine model are not sustainable for base load. And so there's this question, well, what would happen if you added vehicles onto this grid? If you added vehicles, which if you there's a great diagram, there's a great Sankey diagram that I think the Lawrence Livermore Labs has put together, and I found it on Wikipedia, which shows what are all the sources of energy that are consumed in the United States, where it comes from, where it's spent, and the spending is, you know, the broken by commercial, residential, transportation, and I think industrial, and they also account for the waste, which means the heat usually that's thrown off after, you know, that's not used specifically to create motion or create heat for whatever it is you're trying to do with the energy. And the interesting thing is, when you look at this huge diagram, how little comes from renewables and how much comes from petroleum. Now, petroleum is mostly, I mean, I would say probably 80% goes into transportation, but no coal goes into transportation. So you got different fuels for different jobs to be done, right? So coal may go to electricity generation and heating. Some petroleum goes to industrial, but very little, and so on and so on. So they split it all on where it goes and where it comes from. The interesting thing when I looked at that map was like, what if we took all of the transportation needed, and there's a big chunk there, and try to plug in renewables. Let's assume that we use solar power or wind power to drive electric cars. Let's say that's our long-term goal. Well, the problem is that you would reduce the petroleum needed, but then to increase the amount of the amount of renewables would have to go up like a factor of 40 or 50. Maybe it was even more. I don't remember exactly, but it's a huge number. And the problem was, though, that it would have to somehow be stored, because those vehicles couldn't tap into the source. The source would be on generating, you know, energy during the day, let's say if it was solar, but the vehicle would need it at night, because that's when it would stay charged, you know, plugged into a charger. Maybe it could get plugged in at work, but But most of the time, I would think that that's the most convenient way. And so the problem would be to store. It wasn't so much that we couldn't increase the amount of solar panels in the world, although that is expensive in energy, not least of all. But there's just this question of storage. And it's not just the storage in the vehicle, but the storage in the grid. And there's this question of how do you deal with the fact that most power is either, again, base load or peak. So there's an interesting whole discussion about using what is the grid's battery. And people have been debating that for a while, whether we need an alternative a mechanism to store things. Like, people have suggested things like pumping air into large caverns underground and using air pressure as, you pump it up during the day, and then you use the mechanical energy of that pressurized air to power turbines at night. Another one suggestion was you can use chemical processes related to ammonia or even hydrogen, that you could use electrolysis with hydrogen. But they're all very, very problematic, not least of which, again, is that hydrogen is very, very volatile, it can explode, and ammonia is very poisonous. So, there's no good battery system yet. So I think we have enough for one show there just on that topic, but I don't know if we have enough for a whole podcast series.
Well, the one thing I want to toss in there, because, Horace, you make a great point about the demand and storage issues in the grid, but one of the things we talked about in a previous ASIMCAR was the emergence of the information layer solving some of these problems or jobs to be done. And I know BMW, in introducing their new i-Series, the urban electric car, is combining the ability for the owner or the lessor to, lessee, I should say, to use other cars for those longer trips. So I'm wondering, David, if again, there'll be a disruptive, might be too harsh, but another approach using the information layer that combines different services and says, okay, running from this route to A to B, your bus is best, or the subway, or the car service, or what have you. So do you see the information layer emerging combined with changes in regulation? I noticed Oregon's talking about doing per mile taxes, right, instead of gas taxes, because with driving down, they're looking for more income for their roads, obviously. So how do you see the information layer playing out to solve some of these problems, whether it's power storage or routing or the economics of car ownership or leasing?
Yeah, so the economics of car ownership first. I think there's a number of things that are going on simultaneously that will change this, but sort of it can't happen all at once. And so if we have driverless cars, then car sharing or not owning a car becomes a lot more feasible, because then the car that you need can come and meet you instead of you having to go and find it. And so the day that I want a truck, the truck will come to me. Or the day that I want a car for a long-distance trip, the long-distance car will come to me. But we're not at the stage where we have driverless cars, so I have to go and find it. And that's,
it's more time.
Right. And it's more information to acquire. It's a lot harder. So I have to go and figure out, where is the car? It's on streets of Minneapolis somewhere, and I can meet it five blocks away. Well, right. Now I have to walk five blocks, but then I have to also look for the car, and it might not be obvious what the car looks like. And, I might not be that good with maps. So lots of people don't navigate with maps. Those of us who do navigate with maps don't understand those people very well, but there's a whole set of people who don't navigate with maps.
That's true.
I don't know how they get through the world, but they somehow manage. But we have sort of this assumption that, with information, people can find things. I think if we have the information that things can find us, it makes it a lot – that makes the system a lot more valuable to me, and makes it much more likely that, I'll just order up a car and in 10 minutes it'll get delivered to me, a much more likely prospect than I have to spend a half hour hunting it down, and then I have to, it's better than the old rental car model, where then you'd have to spend an hour and half an hour filling out paperwork before you could actually get the car. So having actually this as a service that you already signed up for is an improvement, but there's still a few steps to go before this becomes mainstream for a lot of people and becomes a valuable substitute for a lot of people. But some of it's also an age thing. So younger people might start this way, and then once they're in the system, they're much more willing to use it than somebody who's never used the system. I think one of the problems with public transport in the U.S. is lack of information. And there's a lot of people who've never used or haven't used public transport in 10 years or have never used it. And so doing it the first time is really hard and really scary, and you don't know what's going to happen. And so you just avoid it. But if you get, once you get through that hurdle, it becomes a lot more viable to people. And so if you can do it without having to worry about paperwork or having to have spare change, or, you know, you just sort of tap your credit card down and it's automatically paid for, and you don't have to think about, it's $1.75, do I have three quarters? Those kinds of problems can go away. But you still have the problem of, you know, with public transport, where when it lets you out, how do I find the bus back? How do I find the route back? And we've done a terrible job in the United States of providing information to people. And some, you know, our transit agency says soon people will have smartphones and it will be easy. And it might be easy for some people with smartphones, but I think there's a lot of information out there that we don't need high-tech information technologies to give us. We need low-tech things like informative bus stop signs which tell us, you know, where the buses are. And I feel no fear going around the city of London, taking a bus to somewhere that I've never been before, figuring it and being able to figure out how to get back on a bus and come back to where I started from. Whereas in Minneapolis, I'm a lot less certain about that, because in London, the bus stops are very informative. And in Minneapolis, the bus stops say bus stop, which isn't very informative. So there's a very low level of information technology that we're not even doing, much less sort of the high level of information technology. You know, with driverless cars, obviously, which is a very high level of information technology, that takes care of a lot of problems about being able to get into a car sharing service. And it might save a lot of problems if we have a very smart car about charging, that it will know when it's about to discharge and will automatically drive to the nearest car charging station, supercharging station, so it can recharge its battery or get its battery swapped out or whatever technology winds up taking off, and allow people to make the longer trips without fear that they're going to get stranded somewhere. But a lot of this is fear-based, and I think we have to learn to, you know, there are people who are very fearless about the transportation modes and aren't worried that if they get stranded, they won't be able to figure a way out. But there's a lot of people who think about the negative outcome, and that's enough to stop them from testing anything because it might have a negative outcome. And until we get a lot of people out there proving the system, it's not going to get anywhere near 100% market share. There's a very long learning curve with a lot of these things. And some of it's generational. I mean, Steve Jobs said, you know, I guess you quote about people die, change occurs when people die. I think that's a Thomas Kuhn quote about scientific paradigms originally, that the new scientific paradigm comes about when all the old scientists have died off. And it's true with a lot of things. You look at technological uptake, and there's a great graph in the New York Times a few months ago, which had how long it took various technologies to get to near 100% market penetration. And the technology that was fastest was the microwave oven. You know, that was something that was really useful for people. People could figure it out very quickly. It complemented their existing services. There was very little downside to having it, except for maybe you have food that's not as tasty, I suppose. But that was something that it was very easy for people to see, and it took a short period of time. While the telephone took decades, many, many decades before it reached even 90% market share. And so different technologies will have much different deployment paths. And in transportation, things tend to be on the slow side, oddly enough. You know, roads are extremely, you know, the roads are built infrastructure in the last centuries or millennia. But vehicles, you know, the average age of a vehicle on the road in the United States is 11 years. So it's going to take 20 years just to turn over the fleet. And, you know, people aren't going to want to give up a car that's working unless there's a huge improvement associated with it. So we're talking, you know, from when these things first come onto the market, like in, you know, the last 2 years, first plug-in hybrids. Even if all new cars were going to be plug-in hybrids, it would take 20 years. Or plug-in electric vehicles, it would take 20 years. And before they became universal. And they're not all going to be the first year, and they're not all going to be the second year, and they're not all going to be the fifth year. So it's going to take decades before this stuff becomes standard.
Yeah, so, that's the really the frustrating thing, I think, why we even started this podcast, was because we thought, look how fast things are changing in information and communications technologies. It used to be information. We could say information technology was very rapidly changing because communication technology was slow. But it turns out that now with cellular and eventually with smartphones, that actually communications technologies are changing about as rapidly as computing technologies. And so there's been sort of a hope that we can get some kind of speed up going in new sectors, maybe by sprinkling this magic technology all over the place. But we're seeing obstacles and barriers that are, and we're trying to identify them. Obviously, in transportation, there's one in energy. There's quite a bit of an obstacle there. We need to put our fingers on, and then of course healthcare, education, many other institutions as well. And that's I think Clay Christensen believes in his disruption theory suggests that there are industries which are inherently not disruptible, or which have some sort of man-made obstacle to innovation, and that somehow if we break those obstacles through our own efforts, that we can actually move some industries forward. But there are, you know, that I may be able to buy that on the basis of, let's say, healthcare and education, which are essentially social systems. But when it comes to transportation, there's, I think, physical obstacles. I think this notion of roads. We got speed, we got acceleration in communications because we moved from wires to wireless. Wireless is a lot less difficult to deploy. That's why it scales so rapidly, and that's why physical telephony or fixed telephony took decades or even a century. Wireless took only a few years in many countries to completely penetrate. So we had this technological and this sort of physics breakthrough, and made it possible. Whereas I think in the case of transportation, maybe the grid is the road system, and the road system has a speed limit, if you will, that can't be deployed more rapidly. I think rail is another phenomenon where, if you look at the history of transportation infrastructures, from canals to rail to road, even to aircraft and shipping, that you have these obstacles. In the case of aircraft and shipping, it's actually the port infrastructures that are limiting, not obviously the there are no roadways or paths that are limiting, but it turns out that the ports, the concentration of loading and unloading something, that limits the growth. And so you do have these physical limits. So there are maybe, when you look at transportation infrastructures, there seems to be a speed limit, and it applies regardless of what the technology is.
Anyway. Yeah. One way of thinking about it is that there's a series of layers. And so you have for surface transportation, you have the earth, then you have a right of way on the earth, and then you've got some sort of physical track or roadbed that's on top of that right of way. And then you've got markings which tell you how to use that road system. So you've got lane divisions and things like that. You've got in place a signal control, and then the question of what vehicles are going to be using it. And it's easier to change things that are at the top of the top layer than it is things that are at the bottom layer. You can't move roads very easily. It's not impossible, but it's not very easy. But we can change how we use those roads. Which vehicles are on top of those roads is going to change a lot faster. And so there's room for progress there. But there's other things that we could do. I mean, why are cars as wide as they are, right? I mean, cars are 6 feet wide, 2 meters wide, and lanes are 12 feet wide, 3.6 meters wide. So why are they the width that they are? Well, the width they are because that's what we've standardized on, that cars are going to be two people wide. But if you make cars one person wide, because cars are mostly carrying one person, we could double the number of lanes.
Yep.
And if we have smarter cars, I mean, it doesn't need to be even fully automated, but smarter cars that had much better lateral control, we could make the lanes much narrower than they are, and we could increase capacity. And that's just paint, right? I mean, all we have to do is have the technology for the vehicles working, and we can easily repaint it in principle. But
that's a good point, and that is a more of a social problem than a physical one. I'm reminded when the smart car rolled out, the smart car was unique, not in the width, although it was narrower, but in its length. It was actually half the length of a normal car. And so they proposed in some cities in Europe, why don't we let the car be parked perpendicular to the curb? So that way it would actually still fit in the parking spot lengthwise, but you could probably fit three of them in the space of one parking spot. And so people thought, hey, fantastic, you know, if you see a free spot on the road, you know, we can fit three cars, we'll solve a lot of the parking problems. Well, the parking authorities, the city authorities, would not permit it because the parking costs or the metering was not set up for it, and you'd still have to pay a full parking ticket per car, and nobody felt that they should if they parked in the third of the spot. So, you know, we got into this political discussion about whether you can actually even make a slight change to the system. But I'm hopeful. I mean, we see these bicycles now more and more, even in New York, which I would have never believed when I lived there in the 90s, that we would see city bikes and bike lanes in New York City. But it's coming. So that's hopeful.
Well, great. Yeah. We've had a very deep show. And, David, we appreciate your time today. And, again, we'll put a link to the Transportationist on the show notes. Thanks so much for joining us from Minneapolis today, David.
Well, thank you for having me.
The premise of a SIM car is that the automobile industry will change dramatically when information technologies converge with transportation. This hypothesis comes from having witnessed how the telecommunication and entertainment industries were similarly disrupted by computing. A SIM car enjoys a global audience. We plan to constantly improve a SIM car and will consider sponsorships. Contact Jim Zelmer via email, Jim@asimcar.com.